The Auckland Greens are thinking local and talking to the people with ideas for a better city and a richer future. Every Monday on Green Auckland.
Kia te mihi nui, kia koutou. This is Dave Clendon, your Green MP, and once again, welcome to Green Auckland, which is a program on Planet FM, where we talk about issues of importance of an interest to Auckland and Aucklanders in this great city of ours. As you might recall, last week I was talking to you from Nelson, of all places, with John Stansfield about Fair Trade Fortnight, and I hope you are all lining up a Fair Trade coffee break for this week or in the next 10 days or so. But today we're back in Auckland. My guest today is an academic, a senior lecturer in history at Auckland University. His name's Dr. Paul Tyon. He's an American who has adopted New Zealand as his home for nearly two decades now. He's a teacher of history, as I said, as a researcher. He's also active as the current co-president of the Auckland branch of the Tertiary Education Union, the TEU, which represents both academic and general or allied staff at our universities and at Auckland University particularly. So welcome, Paul, and thanks for coming in to talk to us today.
Thank you, Dave.
Good to have you here. So, Paul, I've given a very general outline of who you are, what you do, so if you might like to fill in some of the gaps for us, please.
Oh, with pleasure. Yes, as you said, I've been here in Auckland and teaching at the University of Auckland for going on 13 years now, and feel very happy and privileged to have this this as my career. I mean, it's the sort of job where I really look forward to going into every day. The area that I teach and research in is U.S. history. I teach the full run from the beginning to the present. But the area that I specialize in my research is the late 19th and early 20th century, from about the end of the Civil War up through the First World War. And that's the period that I tend to think of as the making of modern America, what the U.S. has become in the 20th century in every way. Really, you can understand if you look at that period of time, which is why I've been interested in it. And the other thing I would say is that my research emphasizes labor history, working people, and unions in the labor movement in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I came to that as an undergraduate, pursued it in my graduate research, and it has informed my activism in the TEU and has helped me to sort of enforce my philosophy about tertiary sector unionism and why it's an important thing.
Oh, so it's a nice link, yes, between what you do and what you research and what you practically are doing in the 21st century, yes. That period you're talking about, that's the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, which America was very much at the forefront of that, clearly.
Oh, yes. Well, you could say that it was the period of the rise of big business and mass industrialization. And being the historian here, I would push that origins back to the early 19th century. But the period of time after the Civil War, especially the 1870s, 1890s, the pace, scale, and intensity of industrialization and the kinds of structures and processes and the culture that was part of the development of modern America happened during that year. And, of course, during those very same years, the kind of conflicts over that industrialization, conflicts that were really about the future of America, what trajectory or path would it take? Would it take the path of corporate capitalism, or as dissenters broadly expressed in the Knights of Labor, as well as the populist movement, they believed in what was called the cooperative commonwealth, a different economic and political trajectory, which did not come to pass as a result of those conflicts. But it's an era of great possibility from which I think we can learn lessons for the present.
Hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. So do you think the battle was lost for all time, or do you think maybe we might see a reversion back to some of those older ideas?
No.
Or are we seeing it already?
Well, the first thing that I say as a historian, history never repeats itself, mm-hmm. but we can learn from the past and we can draw inspiration from the past. And I think that those struggles, their very example, are important to keep in mind. And oftentimes the very vision that oppositional movements had in the past, you can't simply translate them to the present, but they can help us to think about the present in new ways, perhaps getting us outside the box and to see matters and problems afresh.
Sure, yeah. So that industrialization, that mass industrialization, America, as you say, established a certain culture, and it's fair to say that has been adopted internationally, that would have, to some extent, did it provide leadership, or at least a step on that road?
Yeah, I think what you refer to is the process of globalization, which of course has been very much in the media and the academy in terms of discussion over the past decade or so. Interesting, though, a English journalist at the turn of the century wrote a book called The Rise of, I'm just not remembering the title correctly, but the course of the world, the United States. In other words, what he identified was this rising industrial power, which had not yet become a global power. He saw in its productive potential the course of the future and the way in which the United States might indeed influence the rest of the world. And indeed, there are debates over just how globalization has proceeded. But one line of thought is to understand globalization as a part and parcel of the extension of American influence economically, politically, culturally, and militarily. And you can see that especially after the Second World War.
Certainly, yeah. And then more recently, some years ago, we heard Francis Fukuyama announce the end of history, didn't we? I guess as a historian, you might take an alternative view to that as well.
Well, if I agree with him, I might be out of business.
Yeah.
But I think those kinds of comments or perspectives, they're short-sighted in a way, in that we've reached the end of a certain way of understanding the present and the past. And that way of understanding the present and the past, broadly, we can associate or connect to the period of the post-war era, and broadly the period we call the Cold War. But with the end of the Cold War and the collapse of Soviet communism, and broadly the way that may have influenced the left and the seeming incapability of left-leaning movements to offer meaningful alternatives, well, yes, you can read Fukuyama's view in that way, but I disagree that simply the collapse of Soviet-style socialism has meant that alternative ideological left-leaning perspectives are discredited or have nothing to offer. I mean, quite the contrary. I think that this is a period in which we can rethink those alternatives. And in fact, given the current crisis, it's all the more necessary.
Yes, yeah. I mean, to be fair to Fukuyama, he was, he's often misquoted and perhaps his statements are taken out of context, but clearly in his mind that was the great ideological struggle had been won and lost. And at the time, I think there's a lot of us who don't actually accept that. No, there's there's that traditional left-right, and I'd argue indeed that green politics is an alternative form of ideology, if you like. We insist that the left-right spectrum is inadequate to the modern age. It's much too one-dimensional.
I would fully agree with you, yes.
Mm. Yeah, cool. So you're moving along, I guess. We could talk about some of that for a long while, actually, but we'd best move on to the topic. I'm interested in your view. You're embedded in the tertiary sector, as I was, for about 14 years, in fact, but that's going back 7 or 8 years since I left there now. Yeah. What, in your mind, in a very general way, what's the role of the tertiary sector in modern New Zealand and New Zealand in 2012 and on?
I tend to boil that question down to two broad areas or ways of thinking about significance. And the first is a broad way of thinking about it. I think the tertiary sector is about fostering an educated citizenry. That is a citizenry that is able to think critically, a citizenry that's informed, a citizenry that can make wise decisions and judgments from the very highest levels of policymaking to the most mundane decisions in everyday life, decisions that may affect matters of the environment, politics, economics. And in my view, it's the broad-based nature of university education that can foster that kind of educated citizenry. And indeed, my teaching, I'm very clear with my students, at least by the end of the survey course that I teach, that the purpose of history, what I teach, it's the content is not going to offer you a guide to the future, but learning about the past and the skills that are required to think about the past, I think, place us in a better position to act into the future. And so I say to them, look, we've gotten to this point in the present in the course, and I say, several or more years ago, I used to end and say, look, the world is out there for you. Go out there and make of it what you will. But in recent years, I tell them this, I say, I'm not so optimistic. I'm worried, actually. And the world needs people like you, young people and older people like you,
yes,
to go out there and to tackle these challenges and to think creatively and return to your community what your community has given to you. I think that in terms of civic pedagogy. And that might be idealistic, but I think it's absolutely fundamental. It's crucial.
Mm.
So that, you know, can take as one broad area of significance and importance. And the second, much more concrete, I think that the tertiary sector does have to equip citizens for meaningful careers. And there's been plenty of discussion recently here in this country, in New Zealand, as well as in the United States, where I'm from, debates and discussion about how well are universities doing that job. And it seems to me the way that you think about that question in turn depends on what you think a university is or should be. Should it be a filtering mechanism that somehow delivers the most able and talented to the top? Or should a university be a sort of a placement agency, a training entity that feeds competent workers into those places in the economy where they're best needed? I tend to agree with those definitions or visions of the university. I return to the idea that I spoke about first.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a challenge there. And I think particularly for staff in my part of the university, the humanities, that is how are we relevant in what we're teaching our students in terms of subjects like history, English, philosophy, and so forth. How useful are those subjects for mm-hmm. students going to the job market? And I return to, again, both the content that these disciplines deliver to students, but also the skills and the way that they help students to be good and critical thinkers in ways that I think are actually quite relevant and useful to the job market. And that is not to take anything off of the science and technology subjects, which are crucially important, but I think need to be understood within that broader context.
Mm, indeed. Yeah, it's interesting. Often you'll hear the critique of content in terms of be it history or indeed languages or classics or indeed philosophy. And yet I think for a lot of people, history is about learning a whole bunch of dates and who did what when and remembering that for the exam. But what are some of these skills? What are the skills you're referring to here that maybe equip people to live in a modern world that can derive from a study of the humanities, of history in particular?
Well, I mentioned earlier, and I begin with critical thinking, right? Mm. Being able to...
Can you teach that, or is that inherent in people, do you think?
No. Well, I think you can teach it, absolutely. But critical thinking begins with a number of other skills, beginning perhaps with reading, information acquisition, and indeed in the courses I teach from the beginning to the postgraduate, we talk about how we can read and read effectively, and critically and actively. Another important skill has to do with writing, effective communication. Mm-hmm. And the humanities are fundamentally about effective communication. And indeed, in my courses, we spend a good deal of time about writing clearly and effectively. And mm-hmm. I challenge any employer in the private sector to say that effective communication is not important.
Yes. No, just about every business manual you pick up, that C word will be right there near the front somewhere.
Absolutely. But, building upon those is about information management. How do we know where to look for what we need to know? This is actually, I think, one of the great strengths of the humanities, not just history, but the ability to identify a problem, know how to think about that problem, knowing where you can look to find the information, what you do with that information once you get it, managing it, analyzing it, coming up with answers and solutions, and then plans of action if there needs to be such a thing. That, I think, is what the humanities can deliver.
Mm. Tell, in your experience, that's a slight divergence, but the fact that students have immediate access now through the internet to massive amounts of information, there is a view out there that students have become less critical, that if something appears on Wikipedia, they immediately believe it's gospel and will act as if it's real. Are you finding that students are less likely to be critical, or rather to be at least to interrogate information before they pass it on as being valid or useful, or less so? Is that over time? Has that changed, you think?
That's a good question. I couldn't answer that specifically in terms of the information and the heaps of information out there. I mean, I thought that when I was young, we had access to lots of information, but it pales in comparison to today. One of the things that we do remind our students is that you got to be very careful about the information out there in the internet. And I do wish them to work with the traditional source, the book, and be very judicious about what they do get off the internet. But I would say that in engaging with my students, they're, if anything, more critical or perhaps skeptical than perhaps in the past. I don't know. And that may be a function of the amount of information out there. I think it's also a function of the age in which we live, which I think is an age of far greater uncertainty, at least than when I grew up or was coming of age in what I thought was an uncertain time in the 1970s and 1980s. I think it's far more uncertain now. And perhaps that is what I see in students, this sense of skepticism, which I see as an uncertainty. And that's something that concerns me.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I've observed that skepticism is a very good thing in one sense, but I do occasionally see that is morphing almost into cynicism. And seeing really cynical young people is something that bothers me. I think it's...
Agreed.
I can understand why they're cynical, and unfortunately the political process is not divorced entirely from that cynicism, to say the least.
I fully agree. I think they have plenty of reason to feel cynical, skeptical, disengaged, disempowered, when in fact, I'd hasten to add, and I do try to say this in my teaching, no, you are not. In fact, there's much you can do. But again, it seems that at times it can be daunting, you know, from the standpoint of somebody in their teens or their 20s these days.
Sure. You mentioned education generally, and specifically tertiary, as potentially a filtering mechanism. I've heard that critique more recently in terms of student loans becoming more difficult to access, not available to mature students beyond a certain age. Now we understand the allowance will only be available for 4 years, which means somebody could do an undergrad, get halfway through a master's, and find the money is cut off effectively. Are these sorts of things that would you see has been particularly helpful? I mean, not sure while I am leading questions here, I ought not to do that. But, but yeah, the tertiary sector as a filtering mechanism.
I think it's a mistake to think of the tertiary sector that way. It may act that way. Certainly that model, you know, we've seen and heard discussion of it. But in terms of the kind of filtering which I sense or see, and I hasten to add, I'm not an expert here in terms of the current policy from government, but I do see what you're alluding to, or maybe perhaps leading to, Dave, this filtering towards certain outcomes in terms of education and research, outcomes which it seems to me our policy is trying to link directly to the market, to outcomes that can be measured in terms of the market, of benefit to the economy, of benefit to economic growth. And on the one hand, I can certainly understand why we might have that concern. On the other hand, I don't think that the filtering analogy or model and the way that might influence or shape policy is necessarily the best way to reach an outcome that may be of direct benefit to the economy, if that's what we wish to achieve, which I question that as a sole priority in its own right.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it does reflect back to that note, that comment you made about to what extent is a tertiary education just about careers, about vocational training education. And certainly, I mean, I taught at a polytech. There was a great deal of vocational education, and I value that, and I think we all value that, teaching people skills, information to complete particular tasks, whatever it might be, from engineering through the sciences. But I do, like you, I think, feel that if we only educate for careers, there seems to be that danger, particular danger to me, about picking winners or imagining you actually know what the economy or society is going to need in 5 years, 7, 10 years down the track. And to me, that's a pretty difficult thing to forecast, I would suspect.
I fully agree. The thing is that kind of policy can paradoxically get in the way of itself by skewing basic research. Once you start either placing incentives or constraints in that way, I think you run the risk of potentially skewing the kind of fundamental basic research that leads to breakthroughs. The thing about the university viewed that way, not in a filtering way, but as a site or place or community of intellectual engagement, is that it's all about possibility, but it's uncertain as well. And you start to monkey with the very advantages or strengths of the university when you try to filter it that way, if that's the terminology we're using. At the same time, you know, you mentioned picking winners, and if you think in terms of students here, of course, what do we envision in terms of a society? What sort of access to education, to university education, do we wish to have as a society? And do we view education, tertiary education, as a right or as a privilege? And if, depending on either way how you come down that question, is the playing field level in terms of who can reasonably or plausibly expect access to tertiary education? And so when you begin to start thinking in terms of filtering, then you get into a whole host of other, you know, ethical and political questions about the value of education and an educated society.
Sure. Yes, you're opening up some topics here. We could talk about this for a very long time, but we are time constrained. This is Dave Glendon. For those of us who might have just come on board, I'm talking to Dr. Paul Tyon, an historian from Auckland University. His other hat is co-president of the Auckland branch of the Tertiary Education Union at Auckland Uni. Tell us about TEU briefly, Paul.
The Tertiary Education Union is, well, it's a union that represents academic and allied or professional or general staff. The latter bundle or category has different terminology at the different universities.
Sure.
But it's a union that represents both academic and general staff equally. And it is a union, as unions are, which is meant to provide, you know, protection to its members in the workplace, to be an advocate to represent members before management. Our bread and butter, if you will, is negotiating collective agreements which provide for wages and working conditions and outline the policies and procedures that might attend to promotion and professional development, disciplinary procedures and so forth, having those in a contract. On the other hand, the TEU is it's an advocate for the tertiary sector, and in that sense, I like to think about the TEU as more than just a trade union in the narrow sense of the term, if you want to define it narrowly. Rather, we're a group of academic and professional staff who care passionately about the tertiary sector, and we want to see what's best for the tertiary sector. And in that sense, we're all about engaging staff in what we do in our jobs and trying to make the environment as good as possible for our, you know, doing what we are here to do, which is, I mean, I'm not in it for the money. I mean, I get paid well. I'm not complaining about that at all. But I love this job, and I love what I do. And the TEU is about that passion and making that happen. But the TEU is also about engaging with government, and it's also about trying to engage with government in a way that is useful for policy for the tertiary sector.
Yes, it's a classic thing, isn't it? People nearest the front line are always going to know pretty well what's needed and called for. You mentioned the collective agreement. I gather you had a fairly rocky ride at Auckland University in terms of settling the agreement.
Yes, we did. Over the past 2 years, over 2009 and 2010, we were in our branch engaged in a protracted dispute, ongoing negotiations over our collective agreement, which came down to a disagreement between the union and senior management over some core key conditions in the collective agreement, which senior management wanted to pull out of our contract, and which we said, no, we can't have that happen because these provisions which governed promotion, policies around research and study leave, disciplinary procedures are absolutely fundamental to what we do as academic staff. And I should add that this was the academic staff collective agreement. We negotiate two sets of agreements, one for academic staff, the other for professional staff. So this involved academic staff. And we were at a serious disagreement over these past 2 years, and we might have been on the brink of strike action, but fortunately and happily, we did not have to go there. And as the result of high-level facilitation, which, as I understand, the Wharfies and the AFCO meat workers are going through now with their disputes, in our case, that facilitated bargaining, which is an advanced form of mediation, you could say, is what enabled us to come to a compromise in the end, which has, I think, proved satisfactory and workable. And so now we do have a collective agreement. We settled that late last year, and we're in a period where both the union and the senior management are quite interested in developing a positive relationship with lines of open communication and in a way that's productive towards what we do.
Well, that's good to know that the that facilitated bargaining, as you say, did work in that instance, and we do hope that there's a good outcome for the other people, the Ports of Auckland and the tele staff, who are having a really tough time now, for sure. There was a sense, I think, that it's almost odd to some people that academics should organise as a union. People might imagine some sort of professional body or an association, but actually good old-fashioned unions seem to work, certainly in an academic and a professional context like that.
Yes. A tertiary sector union can be a funny union in the sense that organizing academics are strong-minded, smart people.
Tell me about it. Yes, I used to be in there.
So I've only been involved in tertiary sector unionism, and I can't compare it to other types of sectors and unions, but it comes with its own particular challenges. But the fact of the matter, the way I see it, is that academics and certainly professional staff, we're workers. And in the case of academics, we're called knowledge workers, mental workers. We share much in common with professional staff that way. Mm-hmm. But we have to think about the university, the mass university as it developed since the Second World War, in the United States and other, parts of the world, as complex organizations which, for better or worse, have been about the production of knowledge, about the production of education, mm-hmm. and in which staff are workers in that sense. And if you look at the United States, for instance, beginning in the 1960s and 1970s, you can begin to see a growing rate of tertiary sector unionism to the point in 1980 where the Supreme Court passed made a decision which then said, no, it put a brake on that tertiary sector unionism. But when it comes to working conditions, such matters as, of course, pay, but for instance, what we might refer to in the living room as potential speed up, when it comes to increasing staff-student ratios, that's a workplace issue.
Sure.
And you can look at that on the one hand as the more students that a lecturer has to teach, that's stretching that lecturer out. Sorry, stretch out rather than speed up, I guess I should say.
Yes.
On the one hand, but it's also an education or teaching issue. And so it's part of there are two halves of the same walnut. And this is what I think makes our kind of unionism and issues a bit unique, because what's in our interest to be effective or happy, productive workers is also in the interest of our students.
Yes, I think we've seen evidence of that to the extent the NZUSA, the student union across the country, or the unions collectively, have on occasion come out quite strongly in support of the teaching, the professional staff, because students, I think, know very well that if we don't have happy and academics who feel that they are at least valued, then it's going to have a negative effect on the learning experience of those young people and not so young people. And of course, increasingly, we are seeing university students who are not coming straight from school, who've got some life experience and so on.
Absolutely. We've enjoyed good relations with the AUSA. They've been very supportive of us over the past couple of years. And it's just as you say, they see how our working conditions affect their experience as students. And so we're very much on the same page that way.
Sure. Well, thank you, Paul. Well, I think that's just about us for the day. It's been interesting talking to you. And you've inspired me to go away and look at a little bit of that early American history, or early
Fantastic.
Modern American history, perhaps, and to look for some of those links. So Dr. Paul Tyon from Auckland University, thanks for coming on Green Auckland. We'll talk some more.
It was a pleasure.
And to people listening, we'll be back next Monday again, 9:05 at Planet Audio. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Aotearoa's most populous city could also be its greenest city. Explore ideas for a green Auckland every Monday at 9:05 a.m. or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/greenauckland.